So we're talking about brain hacking AI, and oh my God, how about 20 other tangents we've either started or sort of put a pin in and hope to get back to? One of those is about we. When Dr. Bart Costco said last hour that we could get to a point where we could download the current edition of a calculus textbook. Well, who is the we? Who's paying for all of this? It isn't just about who's going to govern chips and brains, right? Brains and chips. It's not just about who's going to oversee those people who are overseeing it, but some of it's going to come down to who's going to pay for that, and are we not? Could we? Would we not be creating such an inequality in society that could be the greatest threat to our future, even more so than this battle between brain chips and artificial intelligence and whatever else we can imagine from it? Wouldn't that right there, couldn't that bring upon our collapse if some people had this ability only based on what they could afford? And what might happen to our economy under those conditions? I'll explore that coming up next. Dr. Bart Costco's got all that training, electrical engineering, economics. Well, he's got too many degrees. We'll get to that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Potter. Okay, so I know I've thrown a lot at you, and we may never get back to the very primary questions, which I'm still curious about, like, how do we fight a cyber war if, in fact, we are getting attacked? And I know you've explored subjects like that in both your nonfiction and fiction work. So, but let's go back to the we. When you say someday with brain hacking, we could download the current edition of a calculus textbook. How do we determine who that we is? Who will be the purveyors of this? And what are the implications if A, it's a system that's only set up for people who are financially elite, or B, it's a system that everybody can get a hold of? And so the entire population's intelligence will suddenly, go up like a hot air balloon. Where are you with this?
As between A and B, the answer is B. So just think about who has a smartphone. Most of the planet, it's almost 8 billion people. Most people have a smartphone. You can download a lot of free calculus books right now. Not that people do it, Ian. Unfortunately, I get to teach calculus, and I still do in some classes. But you could. But once you cross those digital thresholds, like for example, with Zoom, that we crossed a bandwidth threshold, it doesn't go back. It becomes wide open. So I'm not worried about whether people can afford to do it. Why? Because we're talking about bits and not atoms. In the world of atoms, you're right. It takes a long time before everybody can afford a car or things like that, but not in terms of downloads. Once we can get chips, which are the flow of electrons that represent information, to talk to your neurons and synapses and modify them, then, as I said, the floodgates will open, and it'll be pretty much off-the-shelf technology. I don't think that'll be the issue. I would coin this term. The effect of so much processed food and inexpensive food, the wild success of markets, has been to make us fatter and less healthy, especially in America, but it's starting to be worldwide. We've
Right.
become couch potatoes. So I would use this term, a chip potato, which is more of our destiny. I'm not worried so much about a big social distinction in every, not like a John Steinbeck 1930s rallies for everybody to have the chip access. I think you'll have that. I think supporting technology at first will be rough, and then it'll be fairly routine.
But what would
And
that
it's
do
not
to our
just chip.
economy if everybody was that smart?
Yeah, that's a hard question, and but it's a different kind of smartness. In the novel Cool Earth, I call this shallow knowledge. Let me give you an example. You look something up on the internet, or God forbid, on Wikipedia or something. You get an answer. You do something else, and I bet in 5 minutes you've forgotten it. That's just the way the brain works, and it's difficult to encode something in synapses. It takes a literal change in the protein structure. We know that. You can see it under a microscope. For example, one of the things you learn in law school, I know they do it in medical school, and I've tried to introduce in many classes, is if you use an acronym, It really helps.
Right.
And a lot of things, as time passed, you only remember from the acronym. And I'll give you an example of one I introduced to help memorize something that's controlling all these processes. I mentioned the four Maxwell equations, which describe the electromagnetic fluid that makes up much of the universe. And with the recognition by Maxwell in the 1880s that waves in that fluid were light. That's really what it is. That's why you see sometimes
right.
the engineering T-shirt that in the spirit of Genesis has the four equations, and it says, Maxwell said, let there be light. Now, those four equations involve the vector calculus, the curl and the dive, like a swimming pool. You'll remember
right.
it that way, Ian. But that's not my acronym. My acronym is FANG, F-A-N-G, like a vampire's fang or a wolf fang. That you'll remember. And the bloodier and the scarier you think of. So that will persist. It'll get encoded, hopefully, in long-term memory. And maybe with training, you'll come back, and it's part of what happens in dreaming. Otherwise, as soon as you switch away from the subject where you might be using the calculus, it's gone. And I don't think you'll have the psychological effect of that. You'll know it. Your pattern, part of the pattern recognition process of brains, of associative memories, is just that property, that name that tune effect.
Right.
So you could name a lot of tunes, like you were playing some classic rock just a moment ago. We can recognize that, but what we cannot do is explain how we do it. So you'll have that, and it's a fairly shallow knowledge, but I think that'll be widespread. It's the transition period where that's commonplace that's quite troubling. Right now, we have an old-fashioned K-12 system in this country that's really falling to the bottom of the industrialized world. It should be going the other direction.
Right.
And that, I think, in the short term, is a much more serious problem about economic inequality and a lot more, just literacy. And in many ways, we're getting lazier in what we download. There's such an overload of information. The opportunity cost of everything you look at, that is the cost of which you're foregoing, is so high, getting higher by the day as more web pages go up for free, that we info snack all the time. And I'll just say, I think every professor, including you listening to me, but especially in the tech world, will agree that over the last 10, 20 years, students have not gotten better at the fundamentals, at things like calculus. And I test that routinely.
Nope, you're right.
And I'll give you one more example. Even the AI guys, who all too often are simply running software that someone else wrote, they don't really understand. Here's a tech question. Can you derive the derivative of a softmax output neuron? I've yet to see an AI guy do that, but yet you can't understand the main AI algorithm called backpropagation unless you can. There's so much follow the leader, groupthink. I can look it up on Wikipedia.
Right.
That is why when I start my main course in the fall, and so like a boot camp for incoming PhD and master's students in electrical engineering and graduate probability, I put a Google sign up and draw the slash through it. It's a non-Google experience. We're going to go back old school and memorize it. And we're not just memorize it, but help you to memorize it and use it, like with acronyms. A lawyer, part of the path, you mentioned the bar exam earlier introduction.
Right.
An awful lot of that is just memorizing really hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of crimes and their elements. Like, for example, larceny has four elements, or tort actions, or evidentiary privileges, and so forth. And you can't just go Google those. They have to be in long-term memory. Now, if we can get to the point that you have a permanent chip, or we can actually encode synapses, that may happen, because we're not just talking about device technology. We're also talking about biochemical technology. Then that may be different. You will have a lot more Einsteins walking around.
Well, the danger of that, though, too, is since it's the primary concern of every system is to preserve its system, then one might surmise from that there would be immediate concern about whether, if we developed it, we shouldn't share it outside of the United States, that we have to protect ourselves, we have to protect our economy, and that if this was something that we came up with, then it wouldn't behoove us to, you know, allow other countries to have access to this technology, so that we would once more again ascend to the top of the food chain.
I got it, but not a chance, my friend. For example, during the break here, I'm on a deadline. Monday night, I have to submit with PhD students two papers, possibly three, to some upcoming AI conferences.
Right.
the stuff, and I put that out there. I work with university. We fight patent battles. We win some, we lose some. But you have to understand that the AI research in particular is almost all done for free and given away online. There might be some disputes with a publisher about what you can put on your webpage. It's extremely difficult to patent an algorithm now, thanks to, I think, a highly misguided decision, unanimous decision the Supreme Court called the Alice decision in 2014. It's been a great gift to America's competitors. But it's not like that. It's not like the two-word famous secret of the H-bomb, which did make a difference when somebody apparently leaked it to the Soviets. What we're talking about is basically publicly available mathematics, free software. You know, so the earlier ideas about imposing a cost, there's a few paywalls, but by and large, this is all free stuff. And when it's implemented in algorithms, it gets in hardware, for example, in software, that's increasingly free, or something you can approximate with off-the-shelf devices. So I think the diffusion of knowledge is almost instant here.
Okay. Now, that brings to my second concern. So that was my inter-concern. An intra-concern would be that, as we have seen recently, there are many forces still at work in our society who would like to see winners and losers, and they would like to decide those winners and losers on the basis of access. And I'm not going to make a political statement out of it. I'm not trying to start anything, but what we know is that there are many powerful people who would take a sort of me-firstism approach, and they would be protecting some people more than others, and they might not cop to that publicly. It might be the kind of thing that they would only say when they thought they wouldn't be recorded or whatever. So how could we guarantee, though, that everybody within the culture would be able to have equal access to this new technology?
So I think what you're laying out is the threat of evolving into a two-class system, a powerful elite at the top and everyone else below. And I can understand the concern, the vanishing middle class.
Yeah.
And I think the answer is to focus on the middle class, both because that's where the majority of people are, and it's a way of raising the poor up and putting them into the middle class. And well, part of that is education, as I mentioned, and we continue to slip. For example, yeah. Mathematics and international rankings for high school students, I think we just dropped to 37th in the lead, of course, is Singapore and China and other countries. But there is something else, though. I mentioned patents and the economic bounty that comes from a short-term monopoly like a patent. And if one way of doing that is going to be harder and harder to get patents approved, because patents have to be, quote, non-obvious, not to an average person, but to an expert. And that's get very hard to do when computers help generate that. In the novel Cool Earth, I talk about patents being basically eliminated because of that. And related to that, when you have a lot of technology and it's partly publicly funded, and these companies, like the big tech companies, emerge ever more powerful, this is where you hear about the universal income idea, which has really been around a long time in economics. And one benefit of that, handing everybody a check, so the collective proceeds, kind of like you get in Alaska from the oil revenue.
Right.
One benefit is what's called the topping off effect. So a lot of jobs that people might not want to do, I mean, I don't think a lot of people go to college saying, gee, I'd really like to get my advanced degree and be a plumber. Nothing wrong with plumbing, but it might well be that you'd be more likely on the margin to do plumbing or other activities of higher skilled labor if you had a cash supplement. So that's one option. On the other hand, it can simply undermine the work ethic. So we'll see. But something like that's likely to happen. Well, what happened with technology, I don't think is something we intended. If we thought about this back in the 90s, that there'd be a small group of people and companies like Google and Amazon, not just having cultural power, but just the sheer amount of money that gets vacuumed up by them and the like. It's in the business model structure that it is not equitable. And I don't think that's sustainable.
And yet, there is precedent for that, though, too, right? I mean, there are plenty of times in our society and in our history when there was some kind of small group at the top that controlled perhaps a disproportionate amount of the technology at the time, whatever that tech was, even if it's something as simple as the railroads or whatever, and then the government steps in and breaks that up. But how could we ever break up the internet? How could we ever break up into smaller versions, something like Twitter or Facebook?
First off, you want to remove barriers to entry. So this is something that people look at. If you look at the enormous profits historically made by these companies, like Google, like Twitter, Amazon's got a different business model, but it's up there too. It raises the question, why aren't there a lot more people starting rival Amazons and Twitters? Something's not right there. There are clear de facto barriers of entry. And that, so you can simply use the antitrust law, and there are cases filed right now that'll look at that. The other problem, I think, that's right now in the culture, and it's a big one here and worldwide, is the cancel culture. And that is something that Justice Thomas recently, in April, wrote a very interesting concurrence when they dismissed a case. It's called the Knight case, K-N-I-G-H-T. And I would urge everybody interested to go to the Supreme Court's site and look up Justice Thomas's concurrence in dismissing the case. But he opened the door, in effect, saying, hey, you guys, send us a case so that we can treat maybe some of these big tech companies. And he has a great analogy to how we first started to treat the telegraph, which is very similar, I think. And then later the telephone, and there was the trains. But the telegraph, again, it's using those four Fang-Maxwell equations, and it was one of the most disruptive technologies and powerful, I think, in history. But there are doctrines. One of them is the doctrine of the common carrier, so that like the phone company, you can't exclude absent some special conditions. So you and I are not being chopped off right now by the phone company. There's also doctrines of the public forum, to the extent that the government has backed the internet and supports that. And other doctrines a little farther out, accomplice liability has been waged by both the political parties, or alleged, that we don't want one party de facto taking governmental actions and farming them out to a tech company. So, but the big tech companies have evolved in a way that I think really is scary. If you remember the old Annie Hall movie of Woody Allen,
yeah,
back in the 70s, Woody famously defined Hollywood as high school plus money. And if you've ever been in Hollywood, it's, you know, accurate that is. I think Woody might want to update some of these big tech companies as basically Hollywood plus the KGB, just in the amount of surveillance and the self-righteousness and the utter opaqueness of these companies, and the least transparent in the history of the world. One of them, like Amazon, run by one guy, Jeff Bezos, and Google by two guys, for example. That I don't think is sustainable. Maybe blockchain will make a difference, people have looked at, but I suspect it'll take a government remedy there, as in the privacy laws, where we shift from atoms to bits.
Okay. By the way, I think it's actually, I believe, Martin Mull is the person who originally was credited with
right?
the joke about, yeah, the entertainment business is like high school with money. I think he gets it originally, but I know he... It is. I often hear other people use it too, so it wouldn't surprise
it's
me.
Wickedly accurate.
If Woody Allen had said it too, but here's the. But again, I come back to is I can't imagine quite what that looks like. And when you say, you know, that, you know, Twitter for a long time didn't make money, right? A lot of these, you know, Facebook didn't make money for a while. Amazon famously didn't make money, and lots of companies didn't. But it took investors with vision, which is part of what our capitalist economy is based on, to keep the cash going. And so when you say, well, how come a rival doesn't exist? Well, maybe it's just because they suck at that. And the thing that the rival wants to do, you know, perhaps, you know, be a platform for other types of viewpoints where they say these are the ones we want to highlight. Nobody wants to invest in that, or people are afraid of losing their money over that, and they may want to invest in it, but they're just not going to. So I want to get back to that, and I also want to get to the cyber war question of what is it that we have in our arsenal. When the president earlier this week, you know, saber rattled with Russia, what is it that could happen if we were to look forward to it? We'll get to that with Dr. Bart Costco next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking with Dr. Bart Kosko from USC, both an attorney and a professor of electrical engineering, and what a perfect conversation partner for all of these potentially scary stories that we're hearing in the news. So much scarier than zombies coming for our brains, because actually the way this would get played out is somehow we would give up our brains for what could be a huge, neat development in the, you know, arc of human history. This coordinated biotechnology of brain hacking. Or it could go terribly wrong, depending on what movie you've recently watched. And we'll get back to that conversation in just a second with some pretty fundamental questions we need to have answered before we get to your phone calls coming up at the top of the hour. This is Ian Punnett. All right, just before I forget it, work with me on this one, Bart, if you would. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about brain hacking, what are the possibilities that someday we might be able to fight an entire war just using our minds? And barring that for the short term anyway, what kind of capability do we have to fight back that the president recently referred to by saying that, you know, well, we have these capabilities to respond to Russian or Russian actors who have been hacking into or trying to plant ransomware into American companies, and we could fight back, and you'll see how we do it coming up. What do we actually have in that arsenal?
Let's take the first question about brains, fighting brains, in effect. I have an earlier novel that got recently re-released called Nanotime, and it coins a new term in the title. What is nanotime? When you get that chip in your brain, or back up the entire brain, which will likely happen, on a chip, you're not going to think and feel and in general have consciousness at the level you do now, not just in terms of qualitatively, but quantitatively in the sheer speed of it. So right now, everything's dictated by the very slow flow of electrons through your neural wires, and the biggest wires from your brain to your toe. And it has a lot to do with stuff that apparently came out of the ocean, salt, and different. I mean, how do you get electricity is the question, out of wet meat, and the answer is ions. But that's a very slow thing, and it's only a couple hundred miles per second in terms of moving your body. If you're in a chip, though, that kind of processing ultimately is only bounded by the speed of light, but it will be orders of magnitude faster and more powerful, not just the ability to edit memories, but just to access other databases. So a few seconds of what I call meat time or current subjective time now could easily be a century, and a lot can happen in that time. So the drama Nanotime, and again, you can look it online, the summary there, it grew out of a phone call from the director, Oliver Stone, who asked for a treatment from me to compete with a movie coming from the late great director Stanley Kubrick. They had competing movies about, as you know, Vietnam, Platoon and Full Metal Jacket. And he wanted a treatment, and I gave it to him, and we tried to get the film made. But ultimately what it was about is what you've asked. What if you have somebody who, in the Jim Moore sense, passes on through to the, breaks on through to the other side, has a chip implant, and is thinking at that level? So everyone else looks like a statue made of flesh, and you have a conflict at that speed. That is so wildly disruptive. It's hard to see where that goes. The book and the what almost became a movie explores that. But easy answer is we don't know. But that's
sounds a little bit like the movie Limitless, by the way, with Bradley Cooper, about him taking a pill that gave him that same effect of being able to, like, learn an entire language in 10 seconds, that kind of thing.
Okay.
It's have like you ever that, seen that?
This goes right down. Again, I'm going to bring everything back to Fang, F-A-N-G. There's four Maxwell equations. They describe the electromagnetic fluid. Nature is very smart. It figured that out. And we use it in our bodies, as my neuromodeling colleague, Professor Daniel Wolpert at Columbia, says. So far as we can tell, the whole purpose of a brain is physical movement. In other words, the only way, as he points out, that we can modify the environment around us is through sweating, through perspiration.
Right.
Plants can be perfectly intelligent in a different way. They've got a different survival strategy. So in that Maxwellian sense, it's all about getting the electrons down. And by the way our biology works is by harvesting free energy from the electrons, the ETC, the electron transport chain. So that's doable in theory, some version of that, and it'll just affect a lot of things. To what extent putting in even a small chip into your brain might affect what you count as now, if it is, for example, a year in a nano time or a femto time or something like that. Very hard to say. Now, in answer to more immediate concerns about cyber warfare, both sides have logic bombs, no doubt, planted, and the other's software and hardware. It wouldn't all be executed at once. Nano time ends in World War III. It's a smart war. And I should mention for the audience that when I was working on my PhD, I used to have a top secret clearance, and I worked for several years in the Cold War on these kinds of things, not chip fights, but on battles. And my first project was working on allocating cruise missiles, for example, that later really was used a decade later in the first Gulf War. So you can put a lot of logic bombs and have them going off at timed moments or timed to key events so that you shut down or constrain the banking system. Some airplanes start dropping out of the sky. But another really easy thing, I think, is just to undermine the food supply. It's so brittle. We have these very smart algorithms that use just-in-time delivery. This is something we worry a lot about here, earthquake country.
Right.
California, you might have heard, had a 6.0 just a few hours ago.
Oh, I didn't know that. No, interesting.
Well, not so much in L.A., but on the border, further up north and border with Nevada. But it's a very big concern, and so after 3 days of no food and blocking the water, you know, it's a lot of social scientists think that's kind of when the street protests, shall we say, are no longer peaceful. Very scary things that you could do that way, and it could take a long time just to undo that and the like. So you could also freeze the military systems, and depending on how far you wanted to take it. One scenario I know a lot of folks have looked at is China invading Taiwan, and that's all too real. And there, it's even more deadly because you could not just knock out some of the GPS satellites and other satellites, but you can undermine them, have them send spurious information. It would be very hard to decode that, not something you're likely to do in real time. There are very crude ways, by the way, for knocking out satellites, and the most crude way is simply detonating a small H-bomb high up like we did in I guess, 1962 in Operation, I think it was Fishbowl or something like that, that knocked out the power and a lot of other things in Hawaii. But, you know, that world in 1962 didn't digitally depend on things. That's a crude way to do it. The Chinese have really taken the lead in anti-satellite technology. They can mechanically knock satellites out. Of course, they can blow them up. And again, in the extreme case, you can achieve an X-ray effect just by detonating a nuke. But that's pretty harsh. I think the more subtle way is just to confuse the opponent. And that we don't know. I mean, it's completely uncharted territory, and I don't know. But I assume they have laid out a sequence of grid points and other things to threaten. I think you're talking about the Joe Biden-Vladimir Putin exchange.
And just recently, when I think it was Thursday, when there was a new series of attacks, an attempt to get through to the RNC, and they were fortunately able to keep out the would-be intrusion, but there was a ransomware that was already planted, that was stopped. I mean, there was a bunch of things, and he said, you know, I'm going to talk to him directly, and it'll be time for us to take action coming up soon. So shall we play a game? What if you were the president, what would be, if you were to make that call, knowing then what's on the smorgasbord here, what would you choose as being the best way to make a statement that didn't necessarily cost human life? We weren't going to drop planes out of skies, but where we could send a message, a shot over the bow to say, don't do this again.
You mean in terms of electronic response?
Yeah.
I would be very hesitant to take out any subsystem of a country that has 1,000-plus thermonuclear weapons pointed at us with superb radar and other systems. One thing, though, I think you can do a little differently, old school, maybe issue, if the Constitution allows, what are called letters of marque, almost like putting a bounty out on these folks. I'm not talking about bringing their scalp in or their head, but some kind of equivalent here. In fact, you might even want to do that with the cartel heads as things get out of hand. It's very tricky because of the plausible deniability of having someone in your country attacking you. Of course, that's exactly what happened with 9/11, and we're just now leaving Afghanistan almost two decades later. It's tough. What I would definitely be doing now is hardening the grid. I know people say that, but we're just not doing enough of it. A lot more redundant systems, and I'd be putting in a lot more sensors up in space. We don't seem to be doing that. There's a big fight going on for space. There's going to be a lot more of it. China is, I think, taking the lead on that. For example, China recently passed America in terms of publishing the most scientific papers. They're not cited the most. We still are. But they have very bold plans for space. And part of making weapons smart of all types is endowing them with a signal processing ability, basically eyes and ears. And it helps to have a lot of sensors out there. They run the risk of false alarms. We almost had a nuclear scenario in the early 70s when somebody thought there'd been a nuclear detonation in space, and really it was something else happening way out in deep space. But I would do that. I would harden the technology. And the other thing you can do, and from a game theory point of view, is simply say, I'm talking about the harder problem of dealing with non-state actors hiding out in Russia or some other country where we have no jurisdiction.
Right.
In a John von Neumann kind of way, you have a list and saying, if we get hit again in ransomware, we're taking the following five entities out by hook or by crook, or maybe not by flying drones, but that sort of thing, because that gives them a disincentive, and it also creates disincentives among those bad actors, because if one of them does something to America, they're in effect jeopardizing all.
Well stated.
Proposals for things like that, yep.
And I'm curious. I mean, I think everybody's watching to see whether this is just one of those things that politicians say but don't ever actually pull the trigger on, or they do it after it's too late, or they'll do it after three more lines in the sand that you must not cross, you know, whether the stalling of that just goes on forever. So, but I love that concept behind nano time, and I think that's a, I think this is, you mentioned the smart war, and I seem to, I think I saw that in some of the literature about you, smart, it was like a World War III, but it was a smart war, right? Did I have that right?
An easy view of that is just all of our smart weapons against all of theirs. What happens at the end of nano time is Israel gets swamped by small rockets, which looked an awful lot like what happened a couple months ago when it had over 4,000 rockets, but they're smarter than that. And the big military principle behind this is that in the digital era, unlike the earlier atom era or chemical era, it's become ever cheaper to attack than defend. So it used to be, you know, to siege the rival castle, you had to go out and camp outside and usually got amoebic dysentery and a lot of other problems. But the advantage was the person defending. That's all changed in the digital world. You mentioned viruses, for example, computer viruses and ransomware. Those are essentially zero cost to induce, extremely difficult to block against, and the like. So as you make drones smarter, as you make drones more weaponized, remember, it's not so much the bang, the chemical effect of the bomb that may be on there, but rather the accuracy, and that's what's getting more powerful all the time. So what happens at the end of nano time is Israel finally gets swamped, and it launches its 300 or whatever they are ICBMs aimed at, targeted so far as we know, at the main Mideastern capitals and military centers. And while that's going on, the Chinese invade Siberia and take it back from their lights. And we reach a new and very ugly new equilibrium. But that's a scary thing, though, of non-state actors leading, in the case of something like Israel, up against the wall. What do they do? Here's another scenario related to that. As we leave Afghanistan, And there's a lot of debates about that, and they're quite legitimate. But one of the original concerns there is Pakistan is the main nuclear power. It has 100 to 200 nuclear weapons. It's spinning at least tens of thousands of uranium cylinder, uranium centrifuges as we speak here, and the potential for a loose nuke goes up. So what happens if you wake up one day and a 15-kiloton bomb like the one we dropped on Hiroshima, a uranium gun, goes off in Tel Aviv or Paris? There won't be any digital or uranium fingerprints in general. And who are you going to hit and hit back? And the demand for that will be very high. And that's the sort of scenario that leads to this game theoretic approach, that you announce in advance, subject to not being gamed yourself, that if certain events happen, you'll respond by taking out the following names on the list, and it's the risk should be on them. Very difficult and scarier by the day. But the fundamental problem is with the shift from atoms to bits. It's cheaper to attack than defend.
Yeah, that part's really
stabilizing
interesting.
Our systems.
That's breakthrough, I think, in the way I was looking at it. It reminds me of something that I used when I was raising our kids called scream-free parenting, which was, we weren't screamers anyway, but it was an interesting proposal that if you had a set response that you agreed upon in advance, everybody's in a good mood, everybody's sitting around, if you kids do A, then B will happen. And everybody agrees on it. And then when A happens and the kids decide to, you know, start throwing rolls at each other in a restaurant, then B happens. You don't have to scream. You don't have to do anything. You just simply get up and activate B. And it it was kind of empowering, I think, to even to put it down on paper is that easy. But it's very much in that same way. You just decide what it's going to be, and this is what's going to happen. And let's all agree on this is what nobody wants this, so don't make us do this. And hopefully that would create its own stasis.
It does, because it creates what the economists call rational expectations. That people bake it into the cake, they factor it in. And very different than having a whole different procedure where the punishment or reward lags too much in time, the behavior. The general finding, you talked about conditioned reflexes earlier, the general finding there is that you want to couple as closely as you can in time the punishment with the action you're punishing.
You know, but
otherwise, it's really not clear what you're reinforcing.
Right. You can't do it. It's not like a dog or something where, like, a week later, you can tell the dog, you remember what you did, and the dog will have no memory of that whatsoever. But when we're talking about using economic theory, I think one thing that's bothered me a lot, I'm sure you keep up on that sort of thing, is how there doesn't appear to be any predictable cause and effect on Wall Street like there used to be. So a company can come out with a dismal earnings report and the stock can go up. That doesn't seem to make any sense. And this sort of thing is happening all the time. Now, maybe it was just a phase, but I want to get back to that in just a second, too, about how can when at a time when our economy depends on constant disruption and reward disruption, what are the traditional, why would we maintain any of the traditional mechanisms or expect that any of the traditional mechanisms would be effective? That's where one of my thoughts will go coming up, but what about yours? We'll give you the numbers to join the conversation with Dr. Bart Kosko. AI, brain hacking, just some of the things we're talking about, the legal problems that we're creating technology that's way ahead of any sort of legal undergirding.